From the studios of Boise State Public Radio, I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on news that made headlines around our region this week. And today, our panel includes Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion writer. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
All right.
Where are we?
Margaret, I want to start with you because you have you ready, Kevin. Hey, Margaret, you and Autumn Robertson did a 6-month investigation into the construction project along Highway 55. You found out a lot of pretty shocking details. Can you just briefly tell us a couple of the things you found out and then the latest on this? Because what came out once you reported on this was that Governor Little had not known about any of these things.
Right. So our reporting, we looked at lots and lots of emails and internal inspection reports from the project, and it turned up that there had been a lot of discussions about slope instability at the project. And it appears that basically they designed the project to have very steep rock walls. They were going to reinforce with bolts and mesh and all of these sorts of steel reinforcing methods. But then as they started the project, they very quickly realized that the rock quality was not nearly as strong as they thought. And so they ended up having to, the first rock slide was due to the fact that the design was just not suited to the rock that was there on the project. And that sparked a whole redesign of the project based on all of the new information that they found out once they started digging. And there was a lot of meetings and indications that the slide at what's called Cut 8, they had known about it and were dealing with really unstable rock prior to that November slide that ended up closing the road for 3 weeks while they studied it and tried to figure out what a next step was.
And so, Margaret, what do you know now? Any updates on this in regards to really the safety and stability of where this construction is still going on?
Absolutely. So after our reporting came out, Governor Little asked for a report, reviewing the reporting and on the safety of the corridor. And third-party engineer McMillan Jacobs put out a report saying that the project is safe and stable. They have monitors installed on the hillside that track if there's movement. The hillside at Cut 8, where that massive landslide happened, has not moved since it slid in November, and they have shored up the bottom of that landslide. So as of now, engineers from both ITD and an outside firm are saying that it is safe and stable, and they expect the project to be done by the fall.
So, Margaret, have you heard from ITD since this reporting? I mean, I know you reached out to them numerous times during your 6-month investigation. And I do know after your report came out, they did have to answer to the governor. But anything in regards to what you're reporting, what you were hoping to ask them?
Yeah. So since the story has come out, ITD reached out. They answered all of the questions that I submitted to them in the week prior to the publication of the story. I've met with them. And then Autumn and I also toured the site for over an hour on Wednesday. And we're going to have a story coming out Monday that basically talks about ITD's responses to our questions, what they say happened, just more details that were not in the story. Some of the things that they told us add more context and new information to our story. Because one of the key details is that they did confirm to us that that first rock slide was due to the design not being suited to the rock quality. That is something that they confirmed from our original story. They also told us that Cut 8 was actually already at a 45-degree angle by the time it slid. And so whenever that rock that they had already redesigned the project to be a shallower angle that they thought would be more stable. McMillan Jacobs said, yep, I think this will keep, you know, this will keep the hillside from sliding. It will solve our issues. And then eventually the hillside did slide. And so now in order to make it stable long-term, they're having to excavate it at a 26 degree angle to vertical. And so in order to put that in perspective, it's just a lot of numbers. That is an incredibly flat hillside, and it required 100,000 more cubic yards of material to be excavated than they even originally planned from the redesign. And if you drive Idaho 55, you'll see that massive hillside where they're digging. That's cut eight, and you can see how far they've had to dig into the hillside in order to get it flat enough to stop it from sliding. You know, we also talked to them about what exactly went into the studies. And so they did numerous studies on the hillside as they were designing the project. But they say that those types of tests don't really allow you to learn a lot about what's in the rock until you start opening it up. They did not drill into the hillside until after the landslide hit. Which they said was not fiscally or feasible or fiscally responsible due to all of the difficult terrain, and they said it wouldn't have been effective in developing a design. So essentially, this project required so much excavation in order to make it happen, and there were unknowns in that whenever they started building, and that was the agency says that they really had no way to anticipate what the hillside would look like once they opened it up, which then obviously posed problems.
Well, and you said, Margaret, you will have an update on Monday, you and Autumn Robertson. And for folks who have not read Margaret and Autumn's reporting on this, I urge you to. Margaret, this was excellent reporting, and honestly, the transparency that you were finally able to get from Idaho Transportation Department, I think, came about because of the reporting that you did. So kudos to you and Autumn.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to go read the update and read more. It adds more context to a very complicated project. There's going to be a lot of updates in there.
Yeah, appreciate that, Margaret. Let's move on. Brian, Mike Lindell, who is better known as the MyPillow guy, is apparently making some, is it fair to call them election fraud claims about Idaho?
Yeah. So these aren't necessarily new. Lindell has been making claims that Idaho's elections were rigged going back to 2020. Of course, Trump won that election in a landslide in Idaho, but he still thinks Trump was robbed of something like 60,000 votes. In an online video, he has sort of his own television network online that he runs. On an episode there, he made the claim that he had a team in Idaho that was looking into other elections, including Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan's pretty stunning loss to Governor Brad Little of about 2-1.
Okay, so those are the latest claims from him. Appreciate that update, Brian. So, Kevin, Reclaim Idaho is once again trying to get an initiative on the ballot in November. Can you tell us about what they're trying to get done? And maybe for folks who don't recognize Reclaim Idaho, they are the group that got Medicaid on the ballot and got it passed.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get caught up on what the initiative would entail and what it proposes. So Reclaim Idaho is pushing a ballot initiative that would raise income taxes and put the money, $323 million by their estimates, into K-12. So the money would come from an increase in the corporate income tax rate, which the legislature had just reduced this past legislative session. And it would also involve an increase in income tax rates for Idahoans making more than $250,000, families making more than $500,000. You'd have an increase on that amount of money above $250,000 and $500,000. And all of that money would go into a fund for K-12. It could go into teacher salaries. It could go into career technical programs. It could go into a whole host of different education initiatives. So Wednesday was a bit of a milestone in this process. Reclaim Idaho turned in their signatures to the Secretary of State's office. It's kind of a complicated process, but basically as an initiative group gathers signatures, those signatures then go to the counties. The county clerks look at the petitions, try to figure out how many of these signatures are valid. Then those reviewed petitions go to the Secretary of State's office for a final look. Reclaim is saying they have more than 100,000 signatures, which translates to, it looks pretty likely that they have met the thresholds to get the initiative on the ballot. Assuming that it is on the ballot, it's a simple majority vote in November as to the fate of the initiative.
So Kevin, so to clarify, they've taken these signatures to the Secretary of State's office. The Secretary of State's office then has to basically make sure that all of the signatures are legitimate, correct?
Yeah, it's the second round of reviewing the signatures. And like I say, a lot of that had been happening at the county level, and what the county mm-hmm. clerks and now the state are looking at is to make sure that these signatures are from actual registered voters, that there isn't overlap, that there aren't duplicate signatures. They're just checking to make sure that Reclaim met the thresholds under state law. And those are complicated, but basically Reclaim Idaho has to gather signatures from at least 6% of the state's registered voters. They also have to hit that 6% threshold in 18 of Idaho's 35 legislative districts, which means that they cannot simply go to one portion of the state, flood mm-hmm. the zone, get all the signatures from Boise, let's say. So we'll wait and see what happens here in the next couple of weeks to see if the initiative is indeed on the ballot. But from all indications, it will be.
Okay. And I think it's important to know that, I mean, that this organization, I mean, was a grassroots effort back when they were able to get Medicaid on the ballot and that passed. So, I mean, Kevin, I think if any group knows how complicated this is, but has been successful in doing it, I mean, it is Reclaim Idaho.
They know what it takes to get on a ballot. They also know what it takes to get an initiative passed. I mean, the Medicaid expansion initiative passed in 2018 overwhelmingly. I think it passed with about 60% of the vote. I mean, that's a pretty sizable victory at the polls. This will be really yeah. interesting to watch if this gets on the ballot. Assuming it does get on the ballot, I'm going to be really fascinated to see who comes out in favor of the initiative. The Idaho Education Association already has. Who comes out in favor, who comes out in opposition? Because in 2018, Reclaim Idaho did a pretty good job of getting a broad-based coalition of supporters behind Medicaid expansion. Really, the Idaho Freedom Foundation was the only group that was actively lobbying and campaigning against the Medicaid expansion initiative. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be interested to see how the fault line develops on this issue, because it's education funding, it's also tax increases. So some powerful forces at work there.
I'm going to be very...
Go ahead, Margaret.
I was just going to say, I'm going to be very interested to see this as well, because we've seen large businesses, large corporations like Micron and others who've talked about the importance of education to growing their workforce and making staying in Idaho sustainable, because they need that workforce. They want a highly trained workforce. And in order to have a highly trained workforce, you need education. So I'm assuming there's going to be some corporate support for, hey, we want to keep the education system stable to grow people who could work for us later. But on the other hand, it is a corporate tax hike. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin. And
it is.
And so that it's going to be that, well, do we want this enough to pay for it? And I'm going to be curious to see where that falls, especially now where finding workers is such a challenge as opposed to, 10 years ago. And IACI, the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry, I think is going to be a major player that I'm going to be watching to see how they're going to react to this.
Yeah, I think IACI for sure. Margaret's absolutely right. Where they come down on this is going to be interesting, because what Reclaim is trying to do really runs against the headwinds of what we've seen at the State House the past few sessions. legislators, Mike Moyle, House Majority Leader, being foremost on this, very concerned about income tax rates, wanting to lower the income tax rates. That's what the legislature has done. That's been their prevailing and recurring tax policy the past few years. Now you have an initiative that would reverse a lot of those decreases. So it's going to be very interesting to watch unfold.
Brian, you've been writing a really interesting series about internet access. This is something that, you know, impacts many areas of the state of Idaho, is not having good access to broadband. But you focused on over in eastern Idaho, in Idaho Falls and Ammon, and how they're leading the way in a fiber optics revolution. So talk to us about this, because, you know, Idaho Falls isn't a big city, and Ammon literally runs into Idaho Falls, and it's even smaller than Idaho Falls.
Yeah, that's right. There's a bit over 60,000 in Idaho Falls and only about 16,000 in Ammon, so they are very small communities. But there is a kind of interesting story about how an emphasis on public infrastructure and having private competition over public infrastructure rather than private infrastructure build out has led to really fast internet, really low prices. And it's somewhat surprising in a pretty conservative region that you would have something that some people might call socialism working so well. It's a really long tradition. It goes back, actually to the year 1900 is where you could trace it. That's when the decision was made to light Idaho Falls with hydroelectric power. And so a small plant was built on an irrigation ditch, that led Idaho Falls to, own a power company that they still operate today. And, it actually offers some of the lowest electric rates in the country. But around the turn of this century, they started running into a problem. They have to distribute all this power out to different areas, and they needed a way to quickly get information from one area to another. So they started to adopt fiber optic systems, which were fairly new at the time, to distribute this around. That led to them building this whole backbone that goes along the power lines of fiber optic cable, and that allowed them years later to sort of easily make the decision, hey, why don't we start selling this to residents? Ammon in turn saw what was going on in Idaho Falls, developed its own model that's been even more successful, and it really built it from the ground up, and it's in fact been so successful that what's now called the Ammon model has become something of a nationwide phenomenon. The city of Detroit is about to spend $10 million on a fiber optic network that's explicitly modeled on the network that was pioneered in Ammon, a city of 16,000.
That's what I find fascinating about this is, I mean, when we talk about kind of this fiber optics revolution, that it's coming from these, you know, smaller conservative cities in Idaho, Brian. And here, you know, Detroit is going to what? Spend $10 million on a very similar network?
Yeah, that's exactly what they're going to do. And it's a really interesting design. A classic problem with utilities like broadband is called the natural monopoly problem, which is basically if you go in and you're a company, you lay a bunch of fiber line, you kind of get all the customers wherever you lay your fiber, and you can charge them more or less whatever you want because they don't have any other options. For another company to come in and lay its own duplicative fiber optic line, that's really expensive. And they already know that the existing company in that area, they already own all the customers. So they'd have to, you know, convince them to switch. It's a much more difficult economic proposition. What these cities have done is make sure that the public owns the actual fiber, and then internet service providers get to compete for customers across that fiber. It's really interesting how this works. There are no long-term contracts, so a customer can switch providers within about 5 minutes. if you get angry with your internet service provider, you can switch almost instantly. And so that leads, that competition leads prices to go way down. The cheapest plan in Ammon right now, just for the plan, there are some other costs associated with it, but the plan is only $5.
What?
For yeah, $5 a month.
Wow. Well, and I really appreciate how you describe it in your article. Is think of it as how like UPS and FedEx and the Postal Service compete for customers, but they all use the same publicly owned roads. So that's a good analogy for people to understand this.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to like your electric service, where you probably only have one option, and whatever the electric company decides to charge you, that's what you pay.
Brian, in your reporting, oh, go ahead, Margaret.
Sorry, I don't mean to cut in again, but I really also enjoyed Brian's stories on this. And one thing that I think we should be watching here in Ada County is that Ada County and the city of Boise are currently undertaking some studies and building out a proposal for a broadband network here as well. Ada County in particular has been kicking around the concept of building like a broadband loop around to serve the outer reaches of unincorporated Ada County, which is where the growth is, north of Star and, you know, in the outskirts of the CUNA area. And so the conversations about the Ammon model of doing things came up in my interviews with Ada County. So broadband is not just something that's going on in East Idaho, rural Idaho. I mean, that's a conversation here in the Treasure Valley, too.
Well, and I was just, that's exactly what I was wondering. Is this a model that we could see in other places? Because we even know, and Margaret and Brian, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, there are areas outside of the Twin Falls area that have no broadband access, and that was a real issue during the pandemic when we were in lockdown, and all of these students had to learn at home, and a lot of kids didn't have access.
Yeah, there are areas like that all over Idaho. And there are some other places in the Treasure Valley that are looking at this. Mountain Home is looking at something similar. I saw some news about Eagle surveying its residents. The one interesting thing about the Ammon model you know, I'm an opinion writer, so I think it makes it a good model for the city of Boise and places like that to look at, is that it provides fiber access not just to growth areas, not just to new subdivisions or wealthier areas, but you can you can provide it to all citizens. You can provide it in the lower income neighborhoods that have often fewer options, less reliable service, things like that. And the price competition is really important there. Because it gives access to lower income families to really important resources. This is one of the reasons why it's been emphasized so much in Detroit, is you know, the ways we participate in democracy, the ways we participate in commerce. These are all online things that we do now. So that's why it's important to look at the model that Ammon's developing, not just as something that can be used in new areas, but that can be done as infill in, you know, dense cities. Ammon's not a huge city by any means, but it's, you know, it's a decently dense city. You know, the look and feel is not too much different than Idaho Falls or Twin Falls, places like that.
Right. And so Kevin, since you are education expert, I mean, this broadband access, I mean, it's always been an issue, but I mean, it really came to the forefront during the pandemic and impacted students in particular in these areas that don't have access to broadband. And I mean, you're talking right outside of Twin Falls. So right. Not, I mean, like, you know, hugely rural areas.
Right. It was absolutely an access issue where you had some, you had haves and have nots. You had communities where the internet access, the broadband was pretty good. And you had other communities where the broadband was not very good. And you layer on top of that, Gemma, you've got the equity issue of affordability. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, some families can afford, you know, broadband, or they can afford an upgrade in broadband, and could, you know, weather that aspect of the pandemic, at least. Other families, you know, just could not afford broadband. So you had schools setting up hotspots in school parking lots so students could, you know, parents could drive their kids to school and they could upload or download assignments. I mean, it was a real test, and, you know, and a stress test that I think illustrates, you know, the severity of this issue and the severity of some of these, you know, inequities in access.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, we've talked about this numerous times on the program, and that's reading scores in Idaho schools. First, tell us why these types of scores matter. But then also, you know, they took a hit during the pandemic. And I mean, part of it is exactly what we talked about, Kevin, in the last segment. And it was this lack of access that so many students had. So they really didn't have the opportunity to learn in a way that they should have been learning.
Right. I mean, you want to talk about a real tangible impact of the pandemic and how it affected learning loss. I mean, you look at the reading scores, there's no question that young readers struggled to pick up reading skills during the pandemic because of the disruption in the school system. So that sets the stage for the numbers that we got this week. The state released the latest round of scores on the Idaho Reading Indicator. And that is a test that goes to kindergarten through third grade students. And what the IRI seeks to do is to try to figure out how do these students measure up in reading skills, or when you're talking about kindergarten kids, you're talking about pre-reading skills, you know, the skills mm-hmm. that form the building block for reading. So the spring scores that came out, about 68% of K-3 students tested at grade level. And that improved by 17 percentage points from where they were in the fall. But you would expect that to happen. I mean, you would expect that over the course of the school year, as these as kiddos are in school and as teachers are working with them, looking at those fall reading scores and figuring out where these kids' strengths and weaknesses lie, you would expect those scores to improve. So the 17 percentage point increase is, it's obviously, it's good news, but it's not really surprising news. What is, I think, significant in these scores is the spring scores from this year were mm-hmm. better than the spring scores that we saw in 2021, the end of that year after the pandemic, yeah. that first school year after the pandemic. And they're almost, in most cases, they're almost where they were in 2019, the spring before the pandemic. So
wow.
when you think in terms of the learning loss, and we know there was learning loss, this would indicate that, you know, kids are starting to pick up ground. They're picking up ground and almost getting back to where students were 3 years ago.
That's really, really good news.
It is encouraging
news. It is encouraging news. I mean, because as a parent with kids in school, that is, you know, you're so concerned about that. I mean, on top of everything else with the pandemic, I mean, you saw that. So it is encouraging. Margaret, you've done a lot of reporting on affordable housing in the Treasure Valley. I mean, this has been a topic of discussion here on the program. We know that it's one of the biggest concerns for Idahoans. So get us updated on what's going on in Meridian and what the mayor of Meridian is or isn't doing, I guess, in terms of affordable housing.
So we had reporting on this at Boise Dev, and then the Idaho Press also did a story where during budget negotiations, the initial proposal was to put $500,000 of money into rental assistance for towards organizations like Jesse Tree to help support people to keep them in their homes. Eventually, the council decided to bring this down to $250,000. But Mayor Simonson said he was really skeptical of, you know, putting city money toward affordable housing. He said he didn't think it was enough of an impact. I'm going to read this quote from him. I thought was very interesting. At the end of the day, we are limited. We don't control land prices. We don't control the labor market or the cost of materials. We are limited as a city to how much we can impact overall affordability. And he also noted that it was, you know, that it was hard to decide, you know, how, what the city should put money towards with helping its residents. He said, you know, we don't support the Meridian Food Bank with our funds. And he said, I would argue food insecurity is as big, if not bigger. So he kind of struggled with that, but ultimately council decided that they were going to put that funding, toward affordable housing. And if I remember right, that, they're still talking to other nonprofits, potentially CATCH and other organizations, about exactly who this money will go to and what it will be for. But he, but Mayor Simonson did have some skepticism about it.
Okay. Interesting. Brian, talk to us about Representative Russ Fulcher co-sponsoring a bill, and this would repeal firearms tax, but we should know this would be... tax from that's taxed federally.
Yeah, so it would repeal a tax that's referred to as the Pittman-Robertson excise tax. This is about a 10% tax on firearms, ammunition, bows, arrows, things that are generally and also fishing gear, things that are used in hunting and fishing, basically. This tax was created about 85 years ago, and it was created at the behest of the hunting and fishing community. The idea was to raise funds for conservation because there were worries that wildlife populations were dwindling and hunters, you know, wouldn't have anything to pursue. And it's been really successful and popular, especially with the hunting and fishing communities. According to Field and Stream, it raised about $1.5 billion last year for conservation. Now, Fulcher's bill came in response to a Democratic proposal that doesn't appear to have much traction. But the proposal was to add a 1,000% tax onto any semi-automatic weapon. So this would hit things like AR-15s that have been used in recent mass shootings and make them unaffordable to most people. But that it's basically a messaging bill. It hasn't really gone anywhere. Fulcher's bill in response, basically would get rid of this firearms tax, and substitute it with money from federal oil leases, which of course aren't tied to hunting. Our editorial board at the Statesman has some problems with, Fulcher's, sponsorship of this bill that we'll make clear early next week.
Okay, so we need to watch to see what happens next week with where this goes.
Yeah.
Okay. Margaret, tell us about some land. I guess there's an office building on it. This is on Americana Boulevard in Boise. This whole area is slated for redevelopment, but it also had some lofty plans few years ago, and those fell through. So, kind of get us updated as to what could possibly be happening.
Right. So we had some permits, some applications put in with the city of Boise from a developer out of Las Vegas to build 350 apartments at the corner of Americana and Shoreline, which is currently home to a medical office building owned by St. Luke's. And if you remember, this is where developers from Georgia initially were considering building a new Hawks stadium that just took fire with criticism and opinions. And it's felt like that was all the city could talk about in 2018 and 2019. But that project ended up falling by the wayside after a ballot initiative. But this area is still in an urban renewal district, and there's a lot of surface parking lots in this area. There's a lot of office buildings. It's very underdeveloped. And so this project would really change that central corner in this area. You drive through there and it just feels like there's so much empty space, even though you're so close to the downtown core. And so if a project like this or others nearby start to come up, then that would likely, we'd start to see momentum building in that area of downtown. And remember, we also have conversations from developer Derek O'Neill, who used to run Boise's planning and development department, to develop in that area around 17th Street, what he calls Midtown, which would be, you know, a new development. So this area of downtown, we're starting to see the momentum could boom. This could be the next boom area. So keep a watch out. It's not just, it's a big apartment project, but it speaks to larger trends in that area.
So if I'm envisioning this right, Margaret, it's that corner of Americana and Shoreline, and I believe there's like an urgent care on that in that lot right now. That's that big area.
Yes, I believe so, and it's near where they were having the Boise Farmers Market in that right, in that building and in those parking lots for a while. So this is some place that right now there's not a lot of people living, and there's just a lot of daytime office type traffic, 9 to 5, people drive in, they go to work, they drive home. But as we know, once you add apartments, you add people. And if you live in an apartment, you're going to want to walk down the street and you're going to want to get a coffee, or you're going to, you know, go to get a bite to eat, or you know, all of the things. And so that would draw more businesses that are not just, okay, I'm going to go in my office, I'm going to shut the door. That would add more vibrancy to that area. And so it's going to be interesting how this evolves and changes as downtown continues to grow and the footprint of what we consider to be the downtown core also grows.
Well, and that area, Margaret, too, I mean, it's kind of ripe for that. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, there's access to getting off the connector. I mean, right there. At 15th, at that corner, I mean, you cross the street and you're at the green belt. You're within walking distance of downtown, frankly. I mean, so I think you're right. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens over these next few years, because there's a lot of you know, unused space, and we could argue whether that's, you know, good or bad. But you're right. As Boise continues to grow, as downtown continues to grow, what will happen to this area?
Right. And as we start to see Boise continue to become more dense, continue to grow, that could change, you know, demand for transit, demand for all sorts of things. You know, once we start having more and more people in living in areas they didn't used to live in, it's just going to change the fabric of what services are offered there. What does the neighborhood look like? What does the streetscape feel like? And this is going to be a major area to just keep watch. And this is also nearby. I know there's major apartments proposed on the site of the former Symposium Lounge, which was another potential stadium site in that area that's nearby. Local Construct is also somewhat nearby, is wanting to build a large development project over on the corner of Whitewater Boulevard, which was also a potential stadium site in that area. So there's all sorts of, like, because whenever the stadium developers were looking for to build in the city, they wanted space. And, and big parcels that are largely undeveloped are disappearing in Boise. And so I think that we're going to keep seeing pressure on these large, particularly parcels that are surface lot, parking for an office building, or even just parking. And we're going to see those sorts of turn over. And then once those large spaces turn over, then the little pockets, the smaller parcels around them, start developing. Oh, I'm going to build, people will say, oh, I'm going to build a little restaurant over here. I'm going to build 5 townhomes here. And then it becomes a neighborhood in a place where we didn't really have a neighborhood before.
Yeah. So Kevin, the University of Idaho is, they've got a bill of $400,000 that they need to pay to Alaska Airlines, but it sounds like maybe they're getting some benefit out of this.
Right. So this goes back to an agreement that U of I and Alaska reached about a year ago. And the idea was, U of I has wanted to get air service back to the Palouse for several years. Alaska agreed to add 5 round trip flights from Boise to Pullman every week for the next 3 years. But the catch was that if the flights did not turn a 10% profit, the University of Idaho would pay a subsidy, would pay up to $500,000 to Alaska to cover you know, to cover the profit that they didn't make, basically. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened this year. So the University of Idaho wound up paying $400,000 to Alaska Airlines. Washington State picked up the remaining $100,000. As I looked into the story and as I asked U of I what happened here and why did they wind up having to pay this money, the U of I is still defending this contract, which goes for 3 years. So there's two more years of this and potentially two more years of subsidies up to $500,000 per year. The U of I is saying, look, we're seeing more students coming from the Treasure Valley. We're seeing an increase in enrollment from the Treasure Valley. And now that is not just because a kid can get on a flight, but that is a factor, they're saying. You know, if we're getting more students from the Treasure Valley, that was the whole objective or a big part of the objective. Connecting students from Boise to the Moscow campus, as opposed to, you know, parents and kids having to drive that beautiful but sometimes treacherous 6-hour drive from Boise to the Palouse. So,
or what you had to do if you. Oh, go ahead, Kevin.
It's a beautiful drive until it isn't, until it's snowing and icy, and then it's it's horribly frightening.
Yeah.
So, yeah. We'll watch and see how this thing unfolds in the next couple of years. Both U of I and Alaska are saying it takes time for people to get accustomed to a new route, get accustomed to a new travel option that they didn't have before. So you don't build up, you know, passenger numbers overnight. But I wonder how this is all going to play out too, because, you know, obviously gas prices have spiked and that may affect decisions that people make about driving their kids to and from campus, but inflation is also going to affect airfare. Fuel prices are also going to affect airfare. I just wonder how that equation is going to play itself out and how that translates into passengers on this route.
Yeah, no, I agree. And let's keep with airlines and airports really quickly. Margaret, we have just about 2 minutes left in the program today, but another project happening at the Boise Airport?
Yeah, I mean, they are just going full bore on upgrading the airport. This project would expand the security area, add another lane, more ID check stations to get more people queued up in the waiting area and through security faster as traffic increases. And that is expected to take about 6 months and should be done next spring, I believe.
Oh, okay. That's and it's necessary, actually, if you've traveled any time with the lines there. I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to join us on this Friday. Always appreciate you. Many thanks to our reporter roundtable, Kevin Richard, senior reporter and blogger with Idaho Education News, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Brian Clark, Idaho Statesman opinion reporter. Thanks, everybody. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Gemma.
Have a good weekend, Gemma.
You guys, too.